Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Susan May Warren.
And I'm Stephen James.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling.
And our guest today, Jeffrey Deaver, is a number one international best-selling author. He's one of the best-known crime writers in the world, and I'm super honored to have him here. His books have been sold in 150 countries, which I think
wow.
is more than the United Nations has, or at least it's close.
That's awesome.
More than 30 novels. Also, you might be familiar with The Bone Collector, was one of the featured releases from Universal Studios, starring Denzel Washington and Angelina Jolie. I remember, I think that might have been when I was first introduced to your stories, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
And so many, many projects going on. I can't even keep up with all of them. But Jeff Deaver, thanks so much for taking the time out of your schedule to share some thoughts with us today.
Oh, I'm delighted to speak to both of you. And I'm, you know, I do write books for a living, but I also teach one-day seminars in the art of, I say, genre writing, because I feel that, you know, good storytelling is important. That's why I you know, appreciate your program, of course. And I have pretty strong ideas about how to tell a tale, and so I like to spread the word as best I can about it. So thank you for having me on your wonderful show.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, I forgot to mention that you're writing, and I think we've even met up a couple times at Thriller Fest, and you
right,
were on
right. mm-hmm.
one of the panels here last year that I was doing, and I was like, I remember sitting, oh man, if we can only get him on the Story Blender, then his career will really take off. So.
Yeah, really. I hope it'll be a big boost for you, you know, and we get a pretty good audience.
If I keep at it, maybe I'll get that book to an agent and they'll buy one.
Yeah, exactly.
You're right, exactly. Oh,
and,
well, I love that you teach those workshops and seminars. That's fantastic. I'll have to sneak
well,
into
I don't
one
know,
of those.
Susan, I don't know if you heard me hesitate a little bit there a moment ago, but I say genre, and I'm always kind of careful about this because, you know, Hamlet was genre writing. The tales of the Song of Roland was genre writing.
Hmm.
And, you know, we look at it as if, well, that's fine art now. So this art versus genre is, I think, kind of a spurious argument. My feeling is that a story is a story,
yeah.
whether it involves
Absolutely.
A crime or romance, the founding of a civilization. And there are certain conventions and, indeed, tricks of the trade that can enhance any story. And, you know, I'd say turn me loose on some of the what we consider the more obscure literary opuses of the past few years, and I'd, you know, I'd kind of whip them into shape because, I do have some pretty strong ideas about how to engage the readers with a good story. And that it tends not to involve the author's self-indulgence, of which we
yeah.
have quite a bit, unfortunately.
Yeah, we do, yeah.
You know, thinking in mind what's best for the reader.
I love that. So let's just follow up on that for a second and say, if you were talking to, now you're talking to a lot of our audience is aspiring writers or even writers that or authors that have been published, you know, and are trying to up their craft. What do you feel is like the number one or number two thing you can do to engage a reader across all platforms? You've got obviously suspense and, you know, romance and all that kind of thing. But what would you say is that number one or number two thing that you could do?
Sure. And I'll just run through this kind of, I guess I could say almost chronologically in the way one would approach writing a novel I'm speaking of primarily, but it would apply as well to short stories. And although I have written a lot of poetry, that's kind of a different bird. So I'm not really speaking of that now. But when it comes to writing a compelling novel or short story, the number one thing that you have to have in mind before you even come up with the idea is that this is a business. You are writing for an audience. You think very hard about what will please them. You know, we don't go to CVS Pharmacy and look at the shelf and see, interesting, liver-flavored mouthwash. You know, that's a really clever idea, but I don't want it. And, you know, you can picture some product designer somewhere saying, I need something that's going to put my company on the map, so I'm going to come up with something that is no, probably reprehensible to most people, but I think it's cool. Well, you can't do that. You have to look at what readers want. And, you know, again, this is, people will say, well, you're kind of pandering to the masses. That's not true. Someone like David Foster Wallace or Annie Proulx, people who write what I consider fine literary novels, Donald Barthelme, the short story writer, those were stories and novels that are a bit difficult. They're not accessible to everybody, but that doesn't mean that when they had in mind their audience, they wrote something very specific for the, you know, the intellectual level, the sociologic demographics of that audience. So although it may be a smaller market than the bulk of readers out there, you know, those who might like my novels or Patterson's novels or The Hunger Games or whatever, nonetheless, it's geared toward that audience. So number one, you have to know who you're writing for and what they want. And, you know, I'm kind of condensing a full day seminar into a few thoughts, but I would say the next most important thing, so that's your philosophy. I write for the readers. I give them something they want, but then we step into, well, what do you write about? And that has to be a story that will make them, make readers continually ask the question, oh my gosh, what is going to happen next? Mickey Spillane came up with a great line. If you or your listeners aren't too familiar with him, he was the great pulp fiction writer from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I don't mean the Quentin Tarantino movie. I mean the real pulp fiction, noir fiction, hard-boiled kind of detective stories. And he said, this is great, people don't read books to get to the middle. So think about it. We pick up a book expecting that the author will have had the wherewithal and the energy to write a book that will drag us kicking and screaming from the first page to the last page. And how do you do that? You raise questions throughout the book. You raise questions, in the case of my writing, crime novels. You raise questions about, well, is the serial killer going to strike again? Will the serial killer get caught? And you raise questions about the love interest between the detective and a witness he meets, for instance, because that soap opera stuff is legitimate, valid plot points to write about in crime fiction. And then I like to throw in some socioeconomic and political issues, too, that continually raise questions. For instance, my book, The Kill Room, there was a crime, there was some romance involved, and there was also the question of the legitimacy of the government targeting U.S. citizens for assassination if they represented security threats. We're familiar with the Anwar al-Awlaki assassination, U.S. citizen killed by the CIA. And I don't say that's good or bad. I just raise the question. But I keep readers thinking all along, oh, is this going to be a good thing or is this going to be a bad thing? So there are many ways to parse what I just described, but that basically is those are the two things that I always keep in mind. The first, what's going to make the readers happy? What's going to make them look forward to this book? And then the second thing is, how am I going to keep them on the edge of their seats and missing their train connections and showing up for work late or not showing up at school to find out what the resolution is?
I love that. I love that. Raise questions in all those different areas. That's really great. I think you're right. People, and that's what happens in the middle. People stop raising questions. And they just start writing in circles sometimes, and never really, you know, solving one problem, raising another one, and then
it's the dreaded middle. And I'll give you, if I can, I don't want to monopolize it.
We love it.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm gonna come to another very, very important point, and this is going to alienate a good portion of your listeners immediately, but I hope it's gonna get them thinking. You need to outline. You need to plan the book ahead of time. Gustave Flaubert said that novels are not made the way babies are made. They are made the way pyramids are made, according to diagrams, charts, architectural plans, and then it's one stone set atop of another, a very laborious job. That's what I do. I spend about 8 months outlining each of my novels.
Wow.
I do the research at the same time. And that's a full-time job. I plan out the beginning, the middle, the end, and I can't tell you how wonderful it was for me to come to this concept of outlining for a couple of reasons. First of all, when you sit down and just begin to write, say you have a brilliant set piece beginning. Remember those prologues? How many thrillers or, frankly, any novel have you read that has a beautiful prologue, very exciting, and then the second chapter, third chapter, still pretty interesting, and then you kind of feel where the author ran out of steam.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's pretty easy to sit down for you folks, your listeners. You all know how to put words together, but coming up with a story is a little different thing. Not to say that it can't be done. Anyone can come up with a good story, but you have to think about it. And so when I do the outline, I'll start with that set piece. Oh, that's great, but I don't write it. I put it maybe on a Post-it note, just an idea of what it's going to be like, put it on a big board I have in my office, and then I think, well, okay, I've introduced some characters here, and I will look to a big empty space, maybe three-quarters of the way along the board, and put a Post-it note up that says, Fred Smith finds a mystery object here. I have no clue what that means, where it comes from, but I put that in there. Then I go back halfway between those two, and I say, Sally Smith loses the mysterious object. And all of a sudden I've got kind of a bit of an idea I'm working with. Then I come up with the idea that Sally Smith is, in fact, somebody, a different identity altogether, whose goal is to kill Fred Jones or whatever his name was. And I put that as the big twist at the end. And over the course of those 8 months, I start filling in things so that I can see the middle of the book. And I see there's a big gap there. I say, well, I need something interesting here. Let me come up with a plot device. And I'll write that in. And little by little, that five Post-it notes become 40 or 50 or 60. And hence the book. I can move those around. I'll get the idea that, I killed too many people. It's really difficult to kill people. No, it's a pain. Believe me, it's a pain in the rear end. Because when you do, if you're a legitimate writer, you have to have consequences of a murder.
Yes, yes.
The police have to be involved, and they are involved in a big way. The media is involved. There are emotional consequences from the next of kin, and you have to deal with all of that. So I'll start out with my first outline is always, I'm going to slaughter eight people. And then I say, now I'm going to have a 5,000-page book if I do that. So I take out three, four, five, six of the murders, and the fact is that less is more. A huge slaughter, you kind of lose interest after a while. With all respect to Game of Thrones, could we just lay off the bloodshed for a little while? Please?
Yeah, no doubt.
Get to something else. And so, but the outline lets me fill in those gaps. And I'll tell you another reason that the outline is very important. Now, you don't have to admit this in person, but I just want you to think about it. I want your listeners to think about it.
Yeah.
Have we not all read a book that should not have been written?
Right.
And I think the answer to that is yes. Just because you have an idea, such as that beautiful set piece prologue, and a word processor does not mean that it should be a novel. Why?
Yeah.
Because what's our first rule? Write something that's good for the readers. And so if you sit down and write that first prologue in the first chapter, in the first, say, 10 chapters, you get 200 or 300 pages of pretty good prose. And then to say, there is really no middle here, and I can't think of a surprise ending, but you tack something on, and you put it out in the stream of commerce, and, we do a disservice to readers, and we do a disservice to the art of writing fiction that way, because we produce something that is less than perfect. Well, if you get to that stage in an outline, and you say, it was a good set piece, but there's no story here, you throw out 40 pages of outline. You don't have that inclination to go ahead and create a shoddy product. You just start on something else. So, hence, I am quite an outline fan. But I will play the devil's advocate here. And having mentioned Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin said, not in response to Flaubert specifically, but speaking on the same topic of outlining and organization, he said that a book is not made the way a building is made, ironically. It is made the way a flower grows. And he, the author, plants a seed with a fair idea that it's going to grow, but he doesn't know what color it is. He doesn't know whether it's going to have 5 buds or 20 buds. He doesn't know if it's going to survive at all in this light. Is he going to have to trim the trees around it? And little by little, he waters and nurtures, and surprise, out comes a wonderful product. So I found that outlining works for me. I'm not particularly bright. I don't have a good memory, so it's helpful to do that schematic. But there are authors who would never outline, and if they did, their work would suffer for it. So I say to your listeners who are writing or hoping to write, do what's comfortable for you. However, I would say if you have an idea, outline through the process first. Give it a shot. Don't do what I do by any means. Spend a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks writing maybe 5, 10, 20 pages worth of outline from beginning to end, and then see how it goes. If you find it way too confining, then discard the idea, but give it a shot.
Now, we've had different guests on, Gail Linz and David Morrell have both. It's so interesting that we finally get to talk to you, because they've been like, oh, our Jeff Deaver outlines, and one will say he has a 200-page outline, then someone will say he has a 50-page. I want to get the record straight. How long are your outlines typically once you've gone through the 8 months of work and you're ready to actually pull the book together?
Sure. The reason the number varies a bit is simply this. I write books of different lengths. For instance, my book, The October List, was 65,000 words. My book, Garden of Beasts, was probably a historical thriller, probably 140,000 words, and it was set, a historical novel, and set in a foreign country. So I had a huge amount of research and planning to do. So the outline for The October List, my shorter book, that was probably 50 to 60 pages. The Garden of Beasts outline was about 220. I averaged between 150 and 200 pages. Now, and I should tell you and your listeners, it is, in fairness, it's single spaced, but it is only half the page, because on the right margin, a very wide right margin, that's where I write the notations for the research. Now, when I do research, I will have probably 40 or 50 sources. A lot of police procedure, a lot of geography. I wrote a book a few years ago about data mining. The villain worked for one of these commercial data mining companies, and used that information as a means to, not only for identity theft, but to kill people, to get ingratiate himself into their lives. As if data mining, weren't scary enough. Harris Keeter, my grocery store, knows everything about me. But imagine a killer getting his hand on all that information. But that took a lot of research. And so what I do is, in the outline, I'll have a scene where, let's say, in that book, it was called The Broken Window, my hero infiltrates a data mining company. Well, what does a data mining company look like? What's security like? So I did a lot of research on that. So when I came to, say, point 45 in my outline, hero infiltrates data mining company, I would flip through my research to, research book number 2, page 55, which describes what a data mining company looks like. So I would simply write 2-55 in the margin next to that section of the outline, so that when I started to write the prose itself, I'd say, oh, okay, now I need to flip open to that research book there, and I'll see what I have to fill in. So yes, the outlines are 200 some odd pages long, but in fairness, I guess we could say if it were the full length of the line, it would be 100 pages. But they are extensive. They certainly are pretty comprehensive.
And
well,
so
I just want to go on the record to say that, Jeffrey, you're my hero. You're my hero, because
no.
Stephen and I are constantly duking this out, because I am a diehard outliner. I'm not quite as I would say committed as you are. The word crazy came to mind, but I went with committed. so you know that's pretty yeah. But I'm with you. I feel like you have to know what you're getting into to see if you even like the story before you're going to spend a year writing it. And so for me, the outline is key for that. And in defense of outlining, going back to what George R. R. Martin said, you know, I think you see this, you plant the story seed and you see it grow as you're outlining, right? Because you, like you said, you say, oh, I'd take this post-it note and say this guy killed this guy here, you know, or whatever. But you see it grow as you outline. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. It is a very organic process. And, you know, the fact is, there's some kind of weird element of creativity or inspiration involved in writing anything. And that I can't speak to. I don't know where that comes from. I've been lucky. I have a very vivid imagination. Sometimes it's too vivid and I have to pull back the reins a little bit. But whether that imagination comes out when you actually, if you were to create the story without an outline, or whether it comes out in sitting back and just imagining where the story will go, that it still has to be there. Now, I don't believe in anything supernatural. I don't think there's a muse. I think there is a some people are simply more creative than others. That's an advantage in some ways and a detriment in others. I was on a panel in England a few years ago, and the subject of where did we authors get our ideas? And the woman sitting next to me was British, and she was one of these doyens of cozy British detective writing.
Yes.
Like Agatha Christie school or Dorothy L. Sayers kind of person. And she said, well, where do I get my ideas? Well, I sit down in my parlor with a cup of tea, and I wait for my muse, whose name was, you know, Frederica or Philomena, actually had a name, to pat me on the head with her wand.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And poof, there's an idea. And I actually made the mistake of chortling. I laughed.
Oh, no.
Because
no.
I thought she was kidding. I thought that was
no.
Yeah. And I tried to turn it into a cough, you know, but that just doesn't work. Something like
that's fantastic.
Steve Carell would do in a movie where he's, you know, in a socially completely inappropriate, awkward situation.
Right.
Himself. It didn't work, and the audience was enamored of her and her muse. And I said, you know, I just try to come up with ideas to scare the hell out of you. And I didn't get any. I didn't get any response at all. But the fact is, you know, I don't believe in a muse of any name. But I do, you know, think there's a well of creativity and imagination, and that everybody has it, and you can tap into it if you so choose. And outcome just some, you know, absolutely marvelous ideas that can, with some work, that is structuring and outlining, be turned into a good story.
Yeah, the idea of waiting for the muse to show up, I mean, I would probably be, well, I don't know, I wouldn't be able to write anything because for some reason my muse doesn't like me. It doesn't show up ever. So
I think Jack London said, you can't wait for inspiration. You have to go after it with a club.
Totally. You go after those ideas. And yeah, absolutely. I think there is some highbrow sort of, well, the muse took me and I just went for it, you know, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And certainly there's those times when you're writing and you're so into a scene that you must, you know, you feel like you almost are just viewing the scene. I don't know if that happens to you, but for me, it's like I get so into it, I'm just sort of a participant in the scene as the characters are taking over, and certainly that happens, but
yeah,
I definitely
that,
don't
I,
have...
Yeah, I remember when that happened once. It was about 8 years ago.
A couple times.
No, I mean, certainly it does happen. You know, I've been writing full-time now for almost 30 years. It's been my full-time job, and I have I've had contracts to do a book a year. I never miss a deadline. Maybe I'm a few days late. And also in that time I've done probably 40, 50 short stories as well. And then there have been some years when I've written two novels. Generally one is a little shorter than my main novel. But, the whole American Express and MasterCard company and Visa rely on me. I mean, I need to I need to keep producing. And so I mean their bottom line and all those employees' kids are going to college thanks to me. So I need to make sure that I produce on deadline. And I'll tell you a story. The other day I knew a short story was due this week, and I had a kind of a rough outline for it. I outlined my short stories too. But I just finished a long tour of Europe. I just done some traveling in this country, and I'd done a couple benefits, and I just did not want to write that short story, but it was due. And so in the course of 3 days, I pumped it out. It was about 17,000 words.
Wow.
And I actually, because again, I knew where it was going. In one day, I wrote 9,000 words. My record, my all-time record.
Wow, that's
and then, of
great.
Course, I had to revise them. It required a lot of fine-tuning. But, that's the nature of writing. And when I teach my seminars, I say right up front to the people who are attending, and these are not for credit. They're just people who want to either write or learn about writing. I say, you have to ask yourself, do you want to have written a book, or do you want to write books? Because they're two different things. And there are
right.
people who want to get it out of the way, tell their life story, or write their Game of Thrones or their Hunger Games or their
sure.
Harry Potter, and then collect the royalty checks. But that's people who think have that attitude. They're really not going to be writers. It's the you wake up in the morning, okay, got to write the story now. Here we go, and this is what is on the schedule, and you write it, and then, 5 o'clock, you have a beer. That's like you came home from the insurance agency, and that's kind of the way a writer's life works. And there are wonderful perks. I absolutely love what I do. It's just so exciting and exhilarating, and I really couldn't do anything else professionally. But it's a job like anything else, and I think
yeah.
a lot of people don't realize that. My friend has a boy who's probably seven, I guess he's 7 or 8, and I can't remember what the context was, but it was something like, "No, Jeff can't." She was saying Jeff can't come over tonight because he's finishing the story or book. He said, "Oh, but he doesn't have a real job. He just writes books."
Right.
Do you hear that from
just
someone
that.
7 or 8? I hear that from people all the time.
yeah, exactly. Adults too, right? Yeah.
yeah, exactly. Well, so this is really good because I am an organic writer. I just call it organic, but I guess you would say just not an outliner. And so I've been really fascinated. I was taking lots of notes on your approach and your techniques. And one of the things that I've often thought is that writing organically, whatever you want to call it, writing,
mm-hmm.
I don't call
oh,
it by the seat of your pants.
That's a good way to put it, sure.
But writing organically, for me, I've never started a book that I know how it will end. So typically
mm-hmm.
my outline for a book is maybe a page for its
right.
premise,
mm-hmm.
really. But I've found that's where my twists come from. In other words, as I'm writing a book, I'm constantly asking myself these questions, how could I end this in a way that's unexpected, inevitable, and so on. But you are known for your twists, and you always have fascinating twists. I've read your books. I've always enjoyed the twists and so on.
Oh,
so
thank you. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that we have, completely different, both of us really value this idea of developing a story that isn't, that's surprising. You can't predict it, but it's satisfying when the twist comes, but yet completely divergent approaches. That's really fascinating.
What I would say about that, Stephen, is that if I were to do an outline very quickly, say over the course of a week, I would probably be in the same situation. But when I spend that much time on an outline,
sure.
I do the same sort of exploration. It's just that I don't write the prose then.
Sure.
So, for instance, I may get to I'll be stymied. And believe me, I've thrown out a lot of outlines. I've started books and the outlines and say, this is just nonsense. It's not going anywhere. But I'll get to a certain point, and I'm blocked, and I think, what on earth is going to be the surprise? I can't think of it. But with the outline, I have the advantage of then jumping to the end or 7/8 of the way through, and knowing the characters at that point, because I have them in mind, I can write a just a notation that there'll be a who knows what, a revelation here, something, a red herring, something comes out of the blue. And I'll put that in, and then I'll go to a different part of the book, and then somehow an idea will occur to me for that roadblock I'd have. So it's the same sort of thing. I just find that an outline for me gives me the luxury of being able to jump around quite a bit, and I never have to think, well, I'm blocked and there's nowhere for me to go from here, whereas that would happen to me if I were writing the prose.
I think our approaches are the same, it's just what you said, you know.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. Also, I find I have a very pedestrian style. I look at a writer like Stephen King, who has, he's like a supernova of creativity. You know, he's like, what do they call those huge stars, the giant red giants or something like that, whatever they are. I don't really know. I stopped
following red giant or something like that.
Red giant, that, maybe that's it, yeah. And, you know what I envy so much about Stephen King, and he, by the way, is like you. He is not an outliner at all. The story just comes out of him. But he will write about, let's say, people walking into a room and looking around and observing the room, and there's no plot point. Nothing happens there. It's just people walking into the room, what they're wearing, what they're thinking, what they may be eating. And he will turn out 3, 4, or 5 pages, maybe a chapter or two of that, and I can't for the life of me bring myself to do that. I have a very pedestrian style. You know, I just get right to it, and it's really hard for me to write those scenes. I have no interest in that. Whereas if I'm having, say, a couple having an emotionally heated discussion about their relationship, or say two law enforcers fighting together about on the same side, but fighting about how to approach a crime, or the killer racked with guilt about something he or she had committed. That I love. That's so exciting to me. But the you know, the basic kind of writing, it's, you have to do it. You have to get people into the room. You have to get them up in the morning and have them shave and do that kind of stuff. But I just don't really enjoy it. So that's why I prefer to do the outline, where I can, you know, bang, nail the scene. Fred wakes up. Okay, he goes to the store. And there he discovers a clue. That's it. And then I'm on to something else. And then reluctantly I go back, and it's always at the end, the final scene. I've got like 8 scenes in my outline, and it's all stuff like that, and I know what happens because I, you know, the book's all pretty much done at that point. But Sally gets in the car, she turns the engine on, she puts the car in drive, she looks out, there's a bird on the tree, and get on with it, Sally. But you have to write it. Just have to write it.
Let me ask a question about a continuing character. This is something that I'm curious about, because there's different kind of viewpoints, I guess, about characters and so on. But when we very often people will talk about, you know, you need your character to go through some sort of change or transformation. But like you've been writing with Lincoln Rhymes, it's Rhymes, yes. I was going to say Lincoln Rhyme, or is there an S at the end?
Actually, it is Rhyme, yes. Without
Sorry about that.
No. Like, it's reported, basically, he's thinking of changing it because it's so misreported everywhere.
Anyway, but so Lincoln is in all of these books, and he's a fascinating character, and yet do you think I want to develop him more? Do you think, do you ever feel pressure like that with a series character to have him grow or change, or does the uniqueness of the character, do you think, draw the readers back?
It's a challenge, because readers prefer series characters. There's no question about that. People like Harlan Coben, who's a wonderful writer, and you might want to chat with him someday, because he's just such a such a talented fellow.
Oh, yeah.
He writes two things. He writes one series. I don't think he's done so much of it lately. His Myron Bolitar series. He's a sports agent who gets involved in crimes. But his main books are, the bigger ones are standalones, no continuing characters. People like Michael Connelly, of course, another fascinating, wonderful writer, has the Harry Bosch series and his Lincoln Lawyer series as well. And people do love those. But then you are, so I, again, rule number one, I want to give readers what they want. But the challenge is to, as in real life, do you change them or not? Do they develop over the years? Now, with Lincoln, and for your listeners who aren't familiar, he is he's kind of a Sherlock Holmesian character, a brilliant forensic detective. The books are set in the present day, but he's a brilliant forensic detective. But he's in a wheelchair. He's a quadriplegic. And part of that condition is his strength in that he has to outthink the villain. He can't go karate kick the bad guy or shoot straighter and save the day that way. So, you know, it was important for me always to have him as a disabled individual who is both heroic, he's a good guy, but he also has bad days. He suffers from a very debilitating condition, and so he's a very realistic kind of person. But my early books dealt more with that, the issue of his disability. But over the years, this has been going on for almost 20 years now, there have been a lot of advances in the care of treatment of spinal cord injuries. And so he's at a relatively stable place now, and the subplots about his health do not come up as much. And readers don't seem to mind that too much. They are much more interested in Lincoln and Amelia, his professional and personal partner, too, solving a good crime, twists and turns and the clever forensic procedures and his deductions, a la Sherlock Holmes. And they like Amelia Sachs, who's the kind of not only is she the love interest for Lincoln, but she's the go-to lady for gunplay and fast cars and things like that. So she's the action hero of the series. So we need that kind of stuff. So I've kind of, both in that series and my Catherine Dance series, I've kind of stabilized everybody. And I don't, they go through various traumas, of course. Poor people in my books never get a moment's rest. But I'm not really focused on major cataclysmic change in their life. And I'm on record to say I'm never going to kill any of them off. I mean, what's the point of that? Readers would be very, very disappointed. And you don't really need to, because I'm going to give them a lot of really fun family members and friends who I'll kill off in a minute. And that will, of course, upset the readers just as much as if I killed the hero off.
Right.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, Jeff, was I thought was really, really good, and that was you said you didn't kill too many people, that there are always consequences and emotional consequences, and I think that is so true and not really brought up that much. People will talk about thrillers or action, whatever, but there is a consequence, and, for me, when I read a book or maybe I see a television series or movie or something, and somebody gets killed, and there are no consequences. Nobody grieves, nobody cries, nothing like this. It doesn't resonate as being believable to me. It's just not how the world is.
Of course. A novel should be an emotional experience. And the reason I write fiction is that I think it's the most enduring and most intense form of emotional artistic expression. And I say that for two reasons. One, I grew up reading books and absolutely loved them. I was a nerd when I was a kid, but I just loved. I read books well before my age, but I knew storytelling was wonderful. Also, I have very little talent for drawing, painting, music. I might feel differently if I did. I don't dance. I can't act. But I'm so that's why I say that I think a book is more emotionally engaging. But I do have some more than anecdotal proof of that. You know, we'll go to a movie, and as much as we enjoy it, it does kind of fade after a while. And we may watch it again, and some classic cinema, certainly we absolutely enjoy that. But when we think back about a book that has captivated, say, the Harry Potter books or Lord of the Rings or, you know, David Foster Wallace or literary writing, if you like, where we create the scene in partnership with the author, and you know, we engage our imaginations, and we are so involved that stays with us. I still remember my images from the reading of The Hobbit when I was a little boy, and I've seen the movies, and Peter Jackson did a great job. I mean, it's kind of tough to turn a 150-page book into three-hour films. I'm not sure they needed to go quite to that extreme, but it was, you know, it was a faithful rendition, and he had clearly read the book and knew what the Shire and what the Middle Earth was about. But I could see those movies 100 times, and I would still, when I think back to The Hobbit, have what was in my mind, what I created when I was about 10 or 11 years old when I read that book. So that's why I think this idea of storytelling on the page is so much more important. Why we have to emotionally engage the readers, and your reference to a bad made-for-TV movie, of which there are many, although some very good work is being done on TV now, but where there's no consequence for the death, the suspense is sacrificed for violence. You know, Alfred Hitchcock, the master of suspense, we certainly never saw a violent death. We never saw Janet Leigh killed in Psycho. Martin Balsam, I think, got a cut on his forehead. Grandma was pretty icky when we found her in the mom, I guess, was pretty icky when we found her in the basement. But that was, you know, she'd been dead a long time. So we didn't have to really worry about the blood and guts. But some of these, you know, I think they call them torture porn movies, the viscera, the blood, you know, the Saw, that's the franchise. Don't we really just get bored after a while? You know, oh, that's the nubile young co-ed, screams, runs back into the haunted house knowing the killer is there. Well, first of all, she deserves it, no question about that. And then, you know, it's kind of a, our response is, oh, let's see, okay, she was strung up upside down because the Christmas tree was actually a trap, and the light wrapped around her foot. Oh, that's kind of interesting. But we don't, you know, we don't get any kind of emotional engagement. And that just requires a little more work on the part of the author, but it's, you know, it's easy, it's pretty easy to do. Also, it gets kind of boring writing scenes of autopsies and serial killers slashing people after a while. Come up with some twists and turns. Make it more exciting for both the author's sake and the reader's.
Yeah, and, you know, I actually think that it demeans human life, like the dignity and value of life, when you just have people, like what you were just explaining, you know, they get killed, and it doesn't affect anybody. And the only thing that, you know, readers or viewers in that case would, it's curious how she died. Well, I'm like, this is supposed to be a real person and a real emotional experience. And even
more troubling is when it's played for a laugh. Now, if you want to do, if one wants to create a black comedy, the Coen Brothers, Blood Simple, for instance.
That was a really good film.
It was great, and it was quite violent, and yet it was it was played for humor. That's one thing. Danny DeVito, Bette Midler film, Ruthless People. It dealt with kidnapping, a murder. We thought a murder was going to happen, but it didn't. And then there is a death in the end. Well, it's comedy. It's humorous. But in a dramatic film, where, for instance, it was whatever else you feel about Mel Gibson. We won't talk politics now, but I'm thinking of one of the Lethal Weapon films. But there was a scene where the bad guys, it may have been Mel Gibson's house, or it may have been Danny Glover's house, his partner. And what's going on, but for some reason there's some construction work going on at the one of the heroes' houses. Right away we're thinking, huh, construction. There's got to be a reason there's construction going on. So then we see them fighting, and you know, I think it was Danny Glover who was being bested by the villain until he looks over and sees a nail gun. Do you know those things, those construction tools?
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Well, kill coincidence, right? So what does he do? He picks up the gun, boom, and shoots the bad guy with it. And, of course, Mel Gibson, who probably got, being the main star, probably had all the good lines. He said, ah, I see you nailed him. Well, you know, that's that was not appropriate. This is a serious film about the Mel Gibson character being very distraught about his wife dying, and yet I'm sure the fellow who wrote the script is listening to this now, but I'm going to say the 27-year-old scriptwriter said, oh, here's a very clever thing we can put in because it made me laugh. But there's no emotion. Mm-hmm. They didn't respect the character. This guy was dead. I mean, he was a hitman.
Yeah.
We don't. There's justice for him. He should be arrested. There are laws against doing that. But no, what they did was they played it for a laugh, and it kind of cheapens the whole experience.
Yeah, no, it's great to hear you talk in some of those terms, because I don't think that there's enough conversation about that. Bringing humanity, emotional tension, emotional consequences, and all these really vital things. And they really affect the very first thing that you talk to us about, and that is satisfying your readers, your audience.
I have to say, too, that we have a bit of responsibility in two senses. One is authors to tell the best story we can, and as accurately as we can. But there is kind of a broader issue with the written word nowadays. We authors are up against very formidable cultural competitors, and among those I list Angry Birds, Minecraft, The Bachelor and Bachelorette, not that I've seen them, well, maybe one or two of them, up against the Kardashians. There's a lot of other forms of entertainment and creative engagement there for the taking, and it's more passive. I mean, work requires a commitment. I'm sorry, writing requires a commitment. It has to be kind of quiet. You have to concentrate on the words. You may have to look up a word you don't know. If you watch the Kardashians, you just sit back and let it flow right over you, and that's an easier sort of thing. And so the lazier we authors are and the more careless and the more we break what I call the give me a break rule, that is by writing something inartfully so that the reader says, oh, give me a break.
Yeah.
The author got lazy. This is not a realistic scene. I don't like all these bad words that seem thrown in, not because they're organic to the character, but because the author simply wants to shock us a little bit. Then we kind of lose the battle. We don't have to look too far to see the bookstores closing. There are certainly a resurgence of small independent bookshops, which I've been very pleased to see. But people aren't—they're not reading the way they used to. I don't think that's the end of the world by any means, but certainly I think we have to make sure that what readers get when they go out into the marketplace is a good quality story that will make their palms sweat or make them cry with laughter or sadness at the emotion. And it's our job.
Yeah, that's That's well said. And before we close up, I do want to say we want to promote. I know that you have a number of books either being re-released in different. I was looking at your website and different issues coming out and some different projects. Anything you want to talk about, new books or projects that you have, and how we could, obviously, sure. We want our readers to connect with you and support you and buy your books. Best place to do that, maybe?
That's great. I appreciate that. All the relevant information in one concise place is jeffreydeaver.com. My latest book is called Roadside Crosses. That's a Catherine Dance. No, I'm sorry. That's the one just before that. Solitude Creek, a sequel to Roadside Crosses, Catherine Dance book. The book that I just finished that will be out next year is called The Steel Kiss. That's S-T-E-E-L, Kiss. It's a Lincoln Rhyme novel. Mm-hmm. And I should add that after your listeners read that book, they will never, ever get on an escalator or take an elevator again.
Ooh, that's a great teaser. I love that.
It's my job to, as I say, emotionally engage readers, and one of the most fun ways to do that is absolute terror. So that's a Lincoln Rhyme book that will be out next year. My book, The October List, which came out about 2 years ago, and that goes backwards, of all things. It's kind of curious. It opens with chapter 36. That's on page one. And you read backward in time back to the first chapter. And
cool.
it's got three or four really big surprises at the beginning. I wanted to write a book that had a surprise beginning as opposed to a surprise ending. And that was just bought by ITV, the big television studio in England. They
fantastic.
They produce Downton Abbey and I think it's called Broadhurst, a number of very good shows. And so that'll be a mini series in England. And kind of an interesting thing that your listeners might be curious about, and this is this will be, I think, helpful for your listeners and for you guys too when thinking about promotion and cross promotion. So what I am doing The Steel Kiss will be out in March of next year. So in February, I'm releasing a short story that is related to the book, and in ways I don't want to tell you because there's some very fun surprises involved. But it's kind of a teaser for the book in a bleak way. So and that will be available, I think, exclusively online for the time being. I'm not quite sure the mechanics of it, but that information will be on my website. And it was just kind of a fun project to do. The title of that is called The Delivery Man, and you can speculate about what he's delivering to whom.
My goodness.
But that's what. And then I'm getting started. I'm writing a new book now, New Lincoln Rhyme for 2017. I'll be two of those back-to-back, set partly in Europe, and where there's a lot going on, as we sadly well know now, it doesn't really have a terrorist element to it. But, it's a global community now, and we do have to address those issues as well.
Right.
It's interesting when you mentioned Roadside Crosses, because that's the book I have in my hand right now. It's interesting.
Oh, wow.
I had set it out, and it has one of the, if people haven't read it yet, it has one of the greatest premises for a crime novel that I've seen in recent years. It's just a great concept, so I will leave it at
that.
Thank
you. That was pretty fun to come up with, I have to say.
Wow. People go read that. So, well, Jeff, this was fantastic.
I
really, really appreciate your time, and everybody, thanks for joining us. Info about my books, you can click to stephenjames.net.
And if you'd like more about my books, you can go to susanmaywarren.com. And if you're interested in story crafting, go to learnhowtowriteanovel.com.
And, of course, other guests and broadcasts and podcasts are all at thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.